The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theworld.
Problem is all inside your head, she said to me.
So, you know this song? 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, Paul Simon. Well, whenever I hear this song, I think of rewriting the lyrics to something like 50 Reasons for Learning Chinese. I know, maybe it's just my own personal obsession, but that's what I think. And there really are 50 reasons, at least. I've come across a bunch of them just among the people in my Chinese class. There are the big ones, family, love, business. And there are many variables just among those, as in, you want to communicate better with your Chinese-speaking grandmother. You want to prove your worth to your Chinese-born father.
You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy.
You want to understand what's going on at in-law get-togethers.
Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much.
You want to get rich, making use of family connections at a factory in China.
Ooh, slip out the back.
Maybe you're intrigued by those thousands of Chinese characters. Maybe you want to convert the Chinese to your own religious beliefs. Maybe you want to find a Chinese wife. A lot of men do. Or maybe you're suspicious of Chinese people and you really, really, really want to know their secret. And I've really heard that one. So today, the pod is all Chinese in one way or another, although we do go all over the world in covering Chinese. First off, some people in the small Central African nation of Rwanda are learning Chinese with the help of a new Chinese government language institute. Then, the introduction of a mandatory class in some Shanghai schools, calligraphy. Education officials are worried that calligraphy and writing Chinese characters will soon otherwise be forgotten. And after a quick translated back and forth between Chinese and American diplomats, we end up here in Boston, where China Radio International is broadcasting to the masses, well, a few of the masses, a select, self-selecting few. So first, Chinese language learning goes global. You know, I've often come across, maybe you have too, these debates online in newspapers, etc., about whether it's actually worth learning Chinese if you're either a native English speaker or you have learned English. The argument against learning Chinese is usually based on two things. First, that it's incredibly difficult and it takes much longer than learning most other languages. And second, that the Chinese are learning English en masse. So everyone's going to end up speaking English anyway. Throw in tech advances and instant translation on your mobile devices and you may end up thinking, why bother? Well, don't tell that to the Rwandans we're about to hear from. Their native tongue, for most of them, is Kinyarwanda. They also speak English, most of them, and possibly a bit of French as well. And now it's bring on Chinese. And they're getting a lot of help from the Chinese government. China is in the midst of a vast expansion of its culture and language centers around the world. They're called Confucius Institutes. And almost 300 of these centers have opened just in the past 7 years, including 21 in Africa. The Big Show's Mary Kay Magstad visited the Confucius Institute in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Late in the afternoon, as long shadows play across Kigali's rolling hills, about a dozen Rwandan students show up for Chinese class. One is Marianne Ayankiamia. She's been studying here for almost a year.
Because I liked to listen Chinese, speak Chinese. Some works they do there in Chinese. So,
do you think you will be using Chinese in the future?
Yeah, I think I will be using it.
Doing what?
Like teaching it, doing some music because I like singing. Amazing.
Sure. The song she chooses is a traditional Chinese song about the beauty of the jasmine blossom. I compliment her on her singing and ask if she knows that the Chinese government has been blocking online mentions of Jasmine this year. It's worried about potential efforts to spread the so-called Jasmine Revolution of the Middle East to China.
Thank you for those news. I didn't hear about it before, yeah.
Classes here focus less on politics than on culture, says Confucius Institute director Kong Lingyuan.
Especially Chinese language and the philosophy of China and the modern China. I want African people to know the real China. Because, you know, right now, African people, they get the news resource mainly from Western world.
And he and his government think Western news coverage of China is too negative. That's one reason China's making an effort now to promote Chinese culture and present its own point of view. But Kong says the Confucius Institutes are about more than that.
In fact, you know, Chinese language will become an international business language. You know, in the market, they have the need to learn Chinese language.
Today, the students are just starting to learn China's national anthem. Rwanda and China will mark 40 years of diplomatic relations next month, and the Rwandan students and their Chinese teachers plan to sing each other's anthems at the ceremony. The teacher, Zhang Guangyu, cues up the Chinese national anthem.
So you read after me.
Yeah.
起来.
起来.
The students move haltingly through the opening words, calling on the oppressed people of China to rise up and use their blood and flesh to overcome their oppressors and build a new great wall, a new China.
起来.
起来.
不愿做奴隶的人们.
不愿做奴隶的人们.
Okay. Next sentence.
The teacher, Zhang, is 28. He came to Rwanda 2.5 years ago. He says he loves it here, especially how the relaxed pace is so different from China's stressful rush. He says he's taught African students in China and finds they pick up language quickly. Many of them speak several. But here, he says, it's a little more of a challenge.
Because they don't have the context to use Chinese, so they don't have much motivation to learn. Even they learn some a little Chinese, but it is not enough to apply in like a Chinese company and to communicate with Chinese in daily life.
But at least some of the students have ambitions to get there. During a break, Inab Sibamana, a 28-year-old physical education teacher, tells me he wants to go to China for a master's degree. He knows if he speaks Chinese, he may get a scholarship from the Chinese government.
The Chinese give Rwandese the chance to go to study there. So when you know Chinese, you have more chance to go there.
Another student, Etienne Tri Kumana, who has his own physical fitness radio show, says he's just interested in learning a language spoken by almost a fifth of the world's population.
From my philosophy, I'm from Rwanda, but I belong to the world. Who knows? Tomorrow I may be needed everywhere. So I don't have a real focus on China, but as China is one of the developing countries, and it had.
Already, Rwanda has shifted from using French to English as the official language of instruction. English is more useful and less politically freighted. French was the language of Rwanda's Belgian colonizers and of the French army that helped the previous government, the one that carried out the 1994 genocide. The Chinese language, by comparison, is simply seen as useful, and the Confucius Center hopes growing numbers of Rwandans find it so. The students still have some work to do on learning China's anthem. But then, the Chinese teachers have to get cracking on learning the Rwandan anthem, too. The Chinese director, Kong, thinks this is important. He says the previous Chinese director here, an older guy, didn't get along well with local people because he didn't show interest in their culture.
When I come here, I learn Kenny Rwanda, and I learn Rwanda national anthem. And I learned Rwanda heritage. So I think if you want other people to learn your culture, you should learn their culture first.
Kong, a PhD anthropologist, certainly seems to live that. He's clearly enjoying his time in Rwanda, not just spreading Chinese culture, but learning Rwandan culture too. When Kong's co-director, a Rwandan woman, shows up, he suggests they sing together Rwanda's national anthem. It's a song about Rwanda's beautiful mountains and lakes and volcanoes, about people living peacefully together. It's the anthem of a post-genocide Rwanda. Kong and his co-director sing with relish to the delight of the students. He may just have tapped into the secret of real soft power, reaching not for power, but for a human connection. For the world, I'm Mary Kay Magstad, Kigali, Rwanda.
So, okay, China's taking its language and culture abroad in a big way. But some aspects of the language and culture are faring really quite badly at home. We've covered this in the pod before. Character writing, for example, is on the decline because technology does the work for you when you type. But also, fewer Chinese study calligraphy, which is the traditional ancient way of writing characters using a brush and ink. So, in some schools in Shanghai, calligraphy is no longer a choice. It's mandatory. Over to the BBC's Juliana Liu.
Well, here we are in the calligraphy studio. Here, students share traditional Chinese tables made of dark wood and carved with intricate bird motifs. And the smell of the black ink used for writing takes me right back to my childhood in South China, where learning calligraphy was required for children as young as 5 years old. It's been a rite of passage for Chinese students for centuries. Learning how to hold a thick goat hair brush and drawing the precise strokes that make up a character. Each one represents the meaning, not the sound of a word. And calligraphy teacher Chen Xiaokang says this skill is more important than ever.
As a Chinese person, how you write represents who you are. There is a saying that goes, if you love China, you must love Chinese characters, because they are so full of meaning. So I feel that a Chinese person must be able to write well.
But educators in Shanghai say because young people are now relying on phone texting and computers so much to communicate, they're losing the ability to actually write those characters. Well, I'm at a classroom with about 30 students, around 12 and 13 years of age. They are learning how to use the computer, and at this age, they seem to be able to do quite a lot. The reason why so much emphasis is being put on computer education is clearly written on the wall in the classroom in large red characters. Mastering information technology, exploring the unknown, becoming a master of the 21st century. But it also means a fundamental shift in the way Chinese is written. On their computers, the students are spelling out, in the Western alphabet, the sound of each word, and waiting for a list of similarly sounding words to pop up on their screen. So they need to recognize the character, but they don't actually need to be able to write it. 13-year-old Liu Hanyuan says when he uses a pen now, he finds he forgets some characters.
When I write by hand, I have to memorize the character, or at least have a dictionary in front of me. But when I type, I just have to be familiar with the keyboard. It is much easier.
At the end of the school day, students wash out their calligraphy brushes. From now on, this class is compulsory across Shanghai, as are new writing exams. Though teachers are hoping it will mean an ancient and complex writing system will be able to withstand the technological challenges of the modern world.
That's the BBC's Juliana Liu. Later in the pod, if you like The Voice of America, you're going to love China Radio International. And the music they play, very Velveeta. Before that, a little thing on sorry seeming to be the hardest word, as U.S. diplomats would have it at least. When they say sorry to the Chinese government, they may not actually mean sorry. Something like that. That's right after this.
The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by Michael Lewis. It's available at audiblepodcast.com/the world.
Okay, cast your mind back to 2001, a few months before 9/11, ancient history. Back in April, there was a huge crisis in relations between China and the U.S. There was a collision in the air over the South China Sea, a collision between an American military jet and a Chinese one. The cause and who was to blame is disputed to this day, but the result was that the Chinese pilot was killed. The 24 crew members on board the American plane, they all survived, but the plane was forced to make an emergency landing on Chinese territory. The 24 were detained, and the Chinese government said they wouldn't be released until Washington apologized. There followed two letters. Letter number one was written by the Chinese pilot's widow to then-President George W. Bush, reiterating the demand for an apology. Letter number two was that apology. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't. Well, you decide. It was written by the then American ambassador to China, Joseph Prua, addressed to the Chinese foreign minister. It came to be called the Letter of Two Sorries. It said that the U.S. was, quote, very sorry for the death of the pilot, and that, quote, we are very sorry the entering of China's airspace and the landing did not have verbal clearance. Two sorries, though, do not make an apology. U.S. diplomats made it clear, at least to their own media, that this letter did not constitute an apology. There are some clearly interesting language and translation aspects to this story. So I'm just going to play a little bit of a conversation that we had at the time between The Big Show's Tony Khan and a professor at Hamilton College. His name is Cheng Li, and he has advised the State Department on Chinese affairs. Here goes.
Both governments should be sensitive to their domestic audience. And in China's case, there's a genuine resentment against what the Chinese people call American arrogance. If a government behaves to be too soft or to be seen to be too soft, it's not popular, and they will be criticized by selling China's domestic interests or national interests. I think it is important the Chinese government can tell the people, yes, U.S. apologize. So probably also give the impression that China wins about this dispute.
Is there anything, do you feel, in the letter from the United States that could be a reason for further misunderstandings as the letter is quoted, translated, and interpreted to the Chinese by the Chinese government?
Because, again, the letter is, you know, I can see the website, it has both Chinese and English. And also in the Chinese version, it says, 表示遗憾,诚挚遗憾,深表歉意. But also they put the English translation, sincere regret, very sorry and very sorry. So I don't think there's a problem here in terms of translation. But early on, there's some problem with translation. And for example, the letter written by the Chinese widow to President Bush, actually there's a very interesting mistake. The mistake is that the widow originally said that you should not be too miserly or stingily in terms of to give apology to Chinese. But that word stingily or miserly translates into cowardly and caused a lot of attention in the U.S. media.
Indeed, especially when that very term is often used for terrorists when they say that their behavior was cowardly.
Yeah, exactly. It's very provocative. And so I think we should look back at that whole incident. I think this is it would be a terrible mistake if we consider that this is the message Chinese wants to send. I don't know who translated that, but definitely in Chinese language does not have this connotation to cowardly.
Okay, well, when an important document of this kind is made and translated for the other side, do both sides have to agree to the language of both sides before it's issued, or can the Americans simply say, look, we give it to you in English, and then you decide how you're going to translate it into Chinese for the Chinese?
Well, no, let me answer that way. Most letters, such as the letter the widow wrote, I don't think you need to go to two sides. But for the letter that the ambassador just has written, and I think that both sides reach agreement that what the translation should be, that's exactly what happened. When I look at the website, there's an English version attached to the Chinese version for these keywords. And so I think we should emphasize common ground, shared interests, because the regional stability and the global peace really needs a cooperative relationship between China and the United States. It's everyone's interest.
Chung Lee of Hamilton College, speaking with The Big Show's Tony Khan. That was quite an extraordinary moment, in as much as, for a few weeks at least, Chinese diplomats were quite outspoken, especially in front of a microphone. They were very good for a quote. And most of the time, let's face it, diplomats, especially Chinese diplomats, keep an extremely low profile. We don't hear from Chinese diplomats who are based here. We don't get anything off the record, and we certainly don't get anything on the record from them. A case in point, the next story. No comment in the face of repeated requests. And this story has something in common with the Confucius Institute in Rwanda story. It's another attempt to exert soft power. I'm not sure if it's successful, but in any case, it is trying to influence in its own small way global public opinion. You can do it, of course, through language learning, through music or dance or film, or you can do it on the radio. The reporter is Anne Donahue.
A Radio 1 station. Boston's home for classic soul. 1090 WILD. Boston.
For most of the last 40 years, radio station WILD in Boston was the go-to place for African-American music, news, and talk, featuring talk shows hosted by the Reverend Al Sharpton and Tom Joyner. But earlier this year, all that changed.
Examining the events that impact and shape China and the rest of the world, this is the Beijing Hour, 1 hour of news and information brought to you twice a day, every weekday by China Radio International.
In June, Boston's home for classic soul quietly turned Chinese when WILD began leasing its airtime to an English language service of China Radio International, a product of the Chinese government.
Frontline brings you a fresh story from modern China and explores the society behind them.
The programs are an eclectic mix of news and information on Chinese culture and society, interspersed with a syrupy English and Chinese pop music and the occasional Chinese language lesson.
I want to learn Chinese.
One hour-long program focused on the Chinese custom of confinement for new mothers in the first month after giving birth. No driving, no leaving the house, no cold food, and no washing your hair? Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam has spent much of his summer listening to the new Chinese WILD. He found some of it amusing. Features on hermaphroditic butterflies and police monitoring snoring at Beijing hotels, for example. But he also found a decidedly pro-Beijing bias in some news stories. Even so, Beam thinks China Radio International might just work.
I think it could easily be as effective as the Voice of America, Deutsche Welle. I think you're hearing Chinese people talking about China, and there's always a huge interest, I mean, all over the world. I think goodwill does spread that way in the sense that people care that others are actually reaching out to them.
While China Radio International has been peddling its programming overseas for many years, an hour here or there, WILD is only the second station in the U.S. to adopt the Chinese format full-time. The radio initiative is part of a much larger charm offensive to try to improve China's image overseas. Beijing has even marketed itself alongside the bright lights of Broadway.
China rented a huge billboard in Times Square to present messages about China.
Harvard professor Joseph Nye has written extensively about China's use of soft power. He says there are limits to how much goodwill China can create through government projects.
I think the Chinese don't understand that a lot of American soft power comes from our civil society. It's outside the government. And the problem that China Radio International faces is that it's a governmental organ. And if it's propaganda, it's not attractive and therefore doesn't produce soft power.
Nevertheless, China is throwing a reported $6.5 billion into this soft power initiative. But AM radio may not get them much bang for their buck. The ratings at the new WILD are dismal. They're reaching only half of their previous audience, about 500 listeners during any given 15 minutes. Radio industry watcher Greg Fitzgerald, whose agency distributes the German-English language program Deutsche Welle, says international broadcasters who pay for play lack the credibility to attract American decision makers. But Fitzgerald says finding an elite American audience may only be part of the Chinese government's goal.
Some people in different ministries like to see dots on a map.
if you are in the information ministry or something else, you can point to that map and say, see, we're on in Boston. People do want to hear what we have to say. And as a propaganda tool, it can be effective within institutions, but in terms of reaching listeners, it has very little impact.
China Radio International is still trying. It broadcasts in 43 languages, including Spanish, Russian, and Arabic, and claims to reach 300 million people. But putting your programming out there is not quite the same as actually finding someone willing to listen to it. For The World, I'm Ann Donahue in Boston.
And would you be willing to listen to this for more than, say, 10 minutes? I thought so. Well, you've listened to more than 10 minutes of the pod. Congratulations. The World in Words is an offshoot of The Big Show, the World Radio program. They're both produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH. You get more info on all of that at theworld.org/language or at the Facebook page, The World in Words. I tweet a ton of language stories that never make it onto this pod. My Twitter handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. Finally, you can hear the pod on PRI's iPhone and Android apps. They're free. To get them, go to the iTunes App Store or the Google Android Market or to PRI.org. If you're still listening, double congratulations. See you next week.